Today is September 5th, 1974. The following interview is with Ann Morgan, M-O-R-G-A-N, a staff assistant. The interview will take place in room 114 of the old executive office building. Terry Good will conduct the interview.
I wrote down a list of names that came to mind that I think you probably have dealt with at some point in the past, so I may ask you about those involved. To start with, when did you join the White House staff?
Almost exactly 5 years ago, in September of 1969.
How did you come to join the White House staff?
Long story.
Well, I don't want a long story, but just enough story.
No, I had wanted to from the beginning of the administration. I was involved in the campaign peripherally since I was a government employee. I couldn't actually work in it, but I had lots of friends who were working in the campaign in 68 here in Washington, and several of them came to work at the White House. And I gave them my resume. One resume ended up with Jim Keogh, who didn't need anybody at the time. And some 9 months later, he found that he did, found my resume. Meanwhile, I had moved from Washington to South Carolina. I was getting ready to move to California, which is why I don't know much about California. I never got there. So I came on back to Washington, and here I am.
What was it that you were hired to do with Jim Keogh?
C.O. Bellinger, who had been here, I think, since sometime in the early part of the Johnson administration, I'm not sure exactly how long, was the only researcher on the writing staff. They had sort of set up the research operation in the Johnson administration, largely, I think, because Will Sparks, who was one of Johnson's writers, knew about the Time research operation because his wife had been a researcher at Time, and he called, this is probably an apocryphal story, but this is the way I heard it told. He called and asked someone to find out for him if there were any Time researchers in the federal government, and they did a computer run and found three or four, and C.L. Bellinger was one of them. He said, I want a Time researcher on the White House writing staff, and she turned up, and she stayed on because Jim Keogh, of course, had been at Time and knew how valuable it was to have that sort of research done. Kept her on, and for, I guess, nearly a year, she did it by herself in the Nixon administration, and suddenly in the fall of 69, she needed an operation and had been pushing for an assistant. Keogh said, fine, we'll hire someone. He hired me. I talked to her for 30 minutes, and she ran off to the hospital and was gone for 6 weeks. So I had a very do-it-yourself course in research.
Who else was on her staff?
She had just Maureen Brown, who was secretary and is now one of the mainstays in the research department.
So, and how long was she on the staff before she left? You were promoted up.
She, I guess, left in, well, of course, she's still on the payroll. She is not really working now, but she's on, as an intermittent employee, has been working on the Nixon papers. But she actually moved from full-time status in
approximately,
I think, January of, no. It was July 1st of 72. July 1st, because I remember that it was just as the campaign was getting going.
So on July 1st, 72, you replaced her.
Right.
What was your title at that point, either officially or unofficially? How did people
I guess I was
you?
Just head of the research office. I can't remember what my official title was. I guess staff assistant. At that time, by that time, we had considerably increased the size of the staff. Pam Giles had been hired, I think, sometime in 19, since she graduated from Mount Holyoke. She had been an intern the summer before I came here, so that was the summer of 69. She must have graduated from Mount Holyoke in 1970. I think we probably hired her that fall or that winter.
So 1970?
Maybe early 71. She worked at the archives for a while first. So She came on and she worked, then she worked in Agnew's staff for a while, so I can't pin down exactly when she came on our staff, but she was the next person who was hired. She and I, for a while, shared the same responsibilities, and then, of course, when I moved up, she was under me. Also, shortly before Mrs. Bellinger left, Teresa Rhodes was hired also as an assistant, so there were two sort of senior assistant researchers in the office at that time, and in the summer of 72, we brought on a number of interns because the campaign was creating quite a few.
But basically, there were three professionals, yourself, Pam, and Teresa.
Right.
And did that more or less carry through the 72 campaign and election?
No, after the summer, we had summer interns, and since we really were, by the fall of 72, very, very busy, we kept on two of those people as full-time employees. Actually, we kept on one intern that we had, and we hired another person, and I think about it, we brought in one guy. Yes, Robin Stickney was the girl who was kept on, and Parker Jane was a male person. Brought in also just to do research.
And they stayed through?
They stayed through the end of the campaign until after the election. Actually, Robin stayed on considerably after that.
Could you give me some brief idea of how the research operation operated?
You have to remember that it's been a while since I've actually done it. I'm trying to think back to the way it has changed. As you can well imagine, with different writers, we operate different ways. As it operated when I arrived and when I was taught how it was supposed to operate, the head of the research office, who was Seal Bellinger, would be told by either Jim Keogh, who was then the head of the writing staff, or by one of the writers that he had an assignment, a speech or a message to Congress or a statement or anything that the writers might be involved in, and that he needed background material for that assignment and when it was due, etc. And either she or I would, first of all, I guess, go to the files and see what we had. Let's use the example of maybe a state visitor who was coming. We would have to prepare arrival remarks and usually a toast for the dinner that would be given for him. And the first thing we would do is check to see whether he'd been here before or whether the person had visited his country and get out the file of the previous things that we had done. In that case, we would then get on the phone and call various libraries and order books and clippings, files, and USIA has a very good file for things like state visitors, clipping file of all the latest information about it. And we'd also probably go to Reader's Guide and see what had been in the news magazines about this person. And gather together just as much information as we could find, then sift through it so that the stuff that's really not going to be valuable to the writer is not included. And maybe do also a memo of some sort to the writer saying the president has met with this person 17 times and he's visited this country 850 times, you know, most of the time at Walter Reed or something like that. Anything that might help the president know or remind the president of his associations with this person. Then we would give that material to the writer who would turn it into something called remarks, which are usually unrelated paragraphs that the president would read and then absorb what he wanted to use in off-the-cuff remarks. He didn't, as you well know, use text very often at all. So often the things that he was looking to us to provide were anecdotes mostly, and that's why we did a lot of reading, especially if there was a person who was coming, to try to find anecdotes that the president might want to use in talking about this person or to him, because the words really weren't as important in situations like this as the nuggets, Lehman used to call them nuggets of information that the person could remember and relate later. The next step that we would do after the writer had then written these remarks, toast or whatever, and usually also there was a fact sheet that was done, which was a very important part of our operation, was providing enough facts to the writer so that he could do a one-page, usually factual piece of paper about the event or the person or the group of people the president was speaking to and any information that the writer thought would be valuable. that was not really in anecdotal or prose sort of form. This material would then come back to the research office at the same time that it would go to the editor-in-chief, who was at that time Jim Keough, and we would check all the facts independently. We'd go back to usually one or two sources to check if there was a quote, for instance, if there was some sources that weren't good enough sources, and writers very, very fond of using not very good sources for quotes, and you would have to go and find another source that had the quote the same way, and you would then have to have a fight with the writer about whether, in fact, he could use that quote if you couldn't find a source. There were many, many times when we would call the Library of Congress at 9 o'clock at night and have them looking through their rare book room for quotes that we couldn't find. But we always did that because it was important if a writer thought a quote was something the president should use, and we thought that the quote couldn't be documented. The burden of proof was always on the research staff to prove that it couldn't be documented. But that's what sort of made it fun. And that I have always thought is the central role of the research office, is making sure that the president doesn't make mistakes. And most of the mistakes that he would make because we'd slipped up were not important mistakes, not, you know, big policy errors, but things that would embarrass him and would make the work of our whole staff look unprofessional and not quite as good as it should be. So lots of what we did was nitpicking, and new writers who came in were always amazed that we would nitpick with such a degree of precision, but I still am convinced that it's a necessary thing to have the president not go out and, for instance, say that there are 14 counties in this state that I visited, when in fact he'd maybe been to 27, just because we screwed up and somebody out there knows and he did the wrong thing.
Now, during the time that Seal was here, either of you two might be doing any of this. It wasn't necessary.
That's right.
It was more or less a democratic operation, I guess.
Very definitely. Very definitely.
And did this carry through when you took over also?
It did. It did. During the campaign, I suspect I probably was a little bit too busy to carry my load of the normal routine checking things, because there was so much to be assigned and so much to be looked over with new people. I had to check over what they did before it went in. But in normal times, everyone in the research office was able to do anything, which really helps when you have long hours, as we do, so that you could have a rotating schedule.
You mentioned that you checked with libraries, USI, and what have you. Did you go to the State Department in case of foreign visitors or dignitaries coming to the country?
We did. The NSC would get a draft from the State Department, from the country desk, usually, I imagine, which they would usually rework or at least read and annotate as to their suggestions about the material. And that material would be sent on to us. Usually, it was very valuable from a policy guidance standpoint. It was usually not terribly helpful for anecdotes and colorful material, but we did have some basic rationing and things like that.
Let's say the president was going to speak at some event within the country. He was going to talk about the economy or agriculture or something like that. Would you contact executive departments over there for information relevant to the topic?
We did, and again, that's something that has changed over the years. Before we had a domestic council, I think we probably dealt with the agencies more directly. Now, if the subject comes up for a major speech, the domestic council will normally be the liaison that we turn to for drafts.
And then you, in turn, would deal with the domestic council.
Right. Again, maybe I'm looking at it now from my current standpoint instead of the research point of view. I suspect that even now, the research people probably deal more with the departments. In some areas, there are some people. When I was down in the research office, I remember that I had a vast network of contacts in the agencies, and some of them were just very, very valuable. There were people at the Census Bureau, for instance, or the Bureau of Labor Statistics, who just were like gold to have on your Rolodex, because they could always put their hands on numbers when you needed them. And there are some things that you just have to go to the source to get. But I do think we now rely more on the domestic council.
Would you ever go outside the federal government for information?
Very definitely. Again, there are some sources that you just learn are very good. One of my favorite stories, and this story is in Jim Keough's book, The Presidents in the Press. The president likes Woodrow Wilson very much, as you know. And he often quoted him, and we would often have a hard time finding the quotes. One reason for that being that his papers have not been published in a very easily identifiable for them. They're all over the place. They've been known by various private people. But there is a person called Dr. Link at Princeton who is now still working on those papers, so they will eventually be published. And we often would have to call Dr. Link to ask him to please look in his files for a quote. And one of my favorite times that we did this was when the president went out on Thanksgiving Eve, and when was it, 1970, I guess, and was going to turn the lights on the outside of the White House and wanted a Wilson quote, which we found, thanks to Dr. Link, at the last minute. It was rushed over to him, and we later found out that during the time that we were looking up the quote, he had called in Wally Hickel and fired him, and then got the quote and gave the quote perfectly when he walked out onto the South Lawn. So it was, we did often call on people like him, or people at the University of Virginia for Jefferson materials. People, let's see what some besides quotes that we would have gone to the outside for. Oh, anything that really somebody on the outside could do better than the government. I remember one year trying to figure out how many Christmas trees there were in the country for the lighting of the Christmas tree, and there's a National Forest Products Association which had a much better idea, I think, than we did of how many Christmas trees there were, because they sold them.
Well, then you might also, let's say if you were going out to speak, I remember at the University of Nebraska you spoke there. Would you have been in touch with any of the people out there to
Yes.
get some local flavor or information?
Yes. Very definitely. Normally, and again, I'm trying to think how it was done in the beginning, because I think that has changed as well. Now we have a system which I think works very well of having a researcher go with the pre-advance party to a place like that, so that the advance team does not have to spend so much of their time getting contacts set up for us and bringing back material for us. I think that the way it worked in the beginning was that we called independently of the advance party, and sometimes that caused problems because we would call people who hadn't been clued in on what was going on, and it works much better if we work with them, although they're very busy, and I think this new system is the best yet. In fact, I remember during the 1970 campaign, when the president was barnstorming, as you remember, for about 2 weeks, he hit, I think, 14 or 15 states in 2 weeks. We had advanced people who would be leapfrogging. You know, they would go to one place, and 2 days later they were in another place, and we're just constantly trying to keep up with them. And they would go in, and they didn't have time to do any of the local caller stuff for us, and so they would just find us a contact and just call his name in. I remember that in Florida, our contact was G. Harold Carswell, who was going to tell us all about the local situation in Florida. But it was fun. I mean, it was very interesting. It was fascinating talking to some of the people that we got hold of as local contacts, and it. They're little things that make a political speech especially more effective, things about the local basketball team or about the bands that are going to be there.
How much documentation would there be in the research files for all the effort and time?
I hope a lot of it, but I'm not, again, those files have not been under my control for a while, and they have changed a bit, I think, when we've had two people come in since. Three people since I've
Pam Giles
followed me. Then we had for a brief period of time a person named Uta Debus last summer who was detailed over from transportation and who did decide to go back to transportation. And then Agnes Waldron, who probably is the best yet, is the current head of the research office. And each one of those people very understandably has reorganized the files. I hope that in the documentation for most of the work probably is in files that would be, rather than subject files, event files. A folder with a speech draft for an event should have most of the work that was done. Some of it might not be in our files, some of it might have ended up in the writer's files, I'm not sure of that.
But at some point we might be able to stumble across documentation that would indicate who was involved in the research, the basic research within the research office. It might have been Bing here and there, and perhaps little notes that would indicate they contacted somebody in one of the departments, who that person was, and
right.
Some idea of what kind of information you got back from them.
Right. One way is that if the research on a certain thing was done well, which it often wasn't.
Well, given the time limitations
right.
that you were under. Experience.
But if a speech had been done the proper way, it would the draft of the speech, which would be in the files, definitely, would have notes written all over it by the researchers, you know, with telephone numbers in the margin and notes in the margin and the researcher's initials at the top of the first page, so that you would be able to tell who had checked the speech and where, what sources she'd gone to. That's a very good way of doing things, because if that person dropped dead in the middle of the checking of a speech, somebody else would come in and know precisely what she had done, and who she had contacted. That was not always done. That was a rule that was honored in the breach, I suspect, more than in the...
Again, you were operating with a very small staff and having to serve how many different speech writers?
That number has varied considerably. I think it has usually been about six to eight.
Before I forget that, could you give me a rundown of the speech writers that you were dealing with at the time you first came on board and then subsequently took over the research shop?
I hope I can remember them all. I guess when I first came, as I say, Jim Keel was head of the staff. Pat Buchanan, Ray Price, and Bill Sapphire were the big three. At that time, they did report through Keo, and they turned their speeches in to him. Lee Huebner, Bill Gavin, and Jamie Humes were sort of junior writers, and Tom Houston, I believe when I first came, was doing some speech writing. He later moved on to do other things. Jamie Humes left, I'm not sure when, it must have been sometime in 1970. Bill Gavin left, I think, I'm not sure these dates at all, that's something you can verify, sometime maybe in 72. And Jim Keough left, I think at the end of 1971. And Ray Price moved up to take his place, and at that time, Bill Sapphire and Pat Buchanan broke off from the staff. They did not report to Ray. They had sort of their own independent status. And Ray brought in Dave Gergen, who was his administrative assistant. And he also hired John McLaughlin and Rodney Campbell.
A couple names that come to my mind, John Andrews.
Right, John Andrews came in just about the same time that I did to the White House staff. He had worked for Ron Ziegler the first year or so, and about the same time I think that Ray came up as head of the staff, John Andrews came over.
Ken Kachigian?
Ken Kachigian had also been on the staff. He, I believe, was on Herb Klein's staff, and he was moved over again by Ray Price to be part of our staff. This again was part of a buildup for the 72 campaign. The staff was expanded quite a bit. Who else I'm trying to think was hired? Jack McDonald came in as a writer in 72. Vera Hirschberg came on the staff as a writer for The First Family. Noel Cook had come on the staff just about the same time that Ray took over. I think it was early 70. Actually, that was early 71 and not late 71. Jim Keough, I guess it was there for two full years in early 71. Ray took over.
Well, that's quite a list of people.
There have been a lot of people on the writing staff.
And any one of those might have called you up and
said,
"Hey, I'm working on such and such."
Did. All the time.
And tight deadlines on dialing in every case.
Right.
What would happen when, let's say, three people were working on three different things that may have had deadlines a day apart or something like that? Was there any sort of a priority? How would you decide which one of these you were going to spend your time
in? The early days, I remember having to go and ask Jim Keough sometimes which one of these things is most important, because I can't do all of them at the same time, and be told. That was, of course, when we just had to, well, even when there was just me at the beginning, it was too much for one person. The staff was much too small. The ratio of writers to researchers, I think, should almost be 1-to-1. In a busy time, when all the writers are going to be busy, you almost have to have one writer serviced by one researcher.
Did you find that on occasion these writers would come in and do their own research?
Yes, they were very good about that. In fact, new writers almost had to be taught to use the research office because they were used to doing their own. And sometimes we had to let them do their own background research or something so we would have time to check things, which they wouldn't do on their own.
And it slipped my mind just how many people were involved in the writing operation.
They came and went. Gradually, Pat Buchanan first, I think, and then Bill Sapphire got out of the speech writing business more or less. Occasionally there would be, especially Sapphire would do a big speech, the economic speech in August of 71, for instance, was his. But as they, the president's workload didn't increase that much, the writers just sort of shifted around in who was doing most of the writing.
Did you continue to provide research support for Buchanan and
yes,
Sapphire?
Yes.
So even though they were out?
Even though they weren't doing as much speech writing, but they were, whenever they had a project, there were a number of very interesting projects that they would come up with that took a lot of our time. And we, of course, had to tell them sometimes we don't have time to do it, but they would come up with, Bill Sapphire particularly, would come up with just wild ideas. I remember doing almost a term paper for him once on the idea of having a labor court for arbitration purposes. He knew it was an idea that had been floated around. It appealed to him, and so he wanted me to do a paper on who had suggested it and why people had said it was not a good idea. I did it. He said, terrific. And he sent it to George Shultz, and nobody ever heard anything about it again.
Well, then you found yourself in a position of having to develop, for a very short period of time, a certain amount of in-depth expertise on some of these topics, right?
Right. Well, it's very educational.
Beyond
right.
the anecdotal level and into the substantive area.
You had to be able to discuss with the experts why you thought something was wrong in their draft they sent to you, things like that. They would, this was very true on, yes, on messages to Congress. The temptation, I think, even maybe in this new administration is going to be to let the departments write the messages to Congress, or maybe OMB, because they know about it, and what do we know about, you know, the details of the legislation, that the person who has written the legislation ought to be able to explain it to the Congress and let them do it. It didn't really work that way. In fact, I found message season to be the most challenging and the most exciting, really, because we were really in the middle of the policymaking process. And lots of times, the policy would be made as we wrote it down, because it sounds better one way, maybe. The policy would be shifted slightly that way. It was an interesting process, and one that I think I learned a lot from, because even the cabinet member would come over and sit down with the writer and the people from his department and from OMB and from the domestic council and whoever else had an interest, and we would thrash out the problems that still remained and the policy that was being made in that message right there.
Yeah, so he would participate in that.
Right. We would, you know, I would be there to make sure that some point that might have been inaccurate in somebody's draft was solved, you know, was settled, and that was the easiest way to do it, was right there.
So it was more than just being a note taker in these meetings, right?
Very definitely, because sometimes we would be the only people, because the writer was too busy writing, who would know that for instance, if you call someone in the department to check an OMB fact, the guy in the department might disagree and say, you know, I don't think that fact is right. And then you have to get the two people together and get the thing solved. You know, or mainly we weren't, you know, challenging the point that was being made by the legislation or you know, some philosophical point. It was often something very technical, like, you know, he would call up and say, is that, you know, when the verb might be, I am transmitting, you would find out whether, in fact, the legislation was being transmitted with that message, and you would find out that nobody really thought about that. Nobody really figured out whether that legislation was going that day or the next day, and whether it was going to be typed up and ready to go when the message was, and little things like that that you have to figure out, because if it's not going to be transmitted, then the president has to say, next week I will send, or the administration will transmit. Little things that sometimes make a difference.
Would you have been the final authority on a message or a bill or something after all the research had been done and gone back to the writer and he checked it out, would it come back to you for any final proofing, either from a grammatical point of view or a substantive point of view?
Again, that varied, largely dependent on how busy we were, I think. At one point, and I think this was probably because there was a line dropped in a State of the Union speech once the president was not happy about it. method, a method developed whereby a person from research would sit down in the front office, and as it was being typed, the researcher would proof it to make sure that every word that was supposed to be there was there, which we always sort of thought was a secretarial responsibility. But again, when you're dealing with presidential speeches, you don't want to take a chance. That is not being done at the present time. It's not a bad idea. Sometimes the researcher is the only person who would catch a number that was wrong, you know, in proofing something if it were being proofed quickly. On messages to Congress, our office had the last word most of the time. Occasionally somebody from the domestic council or somewhere would come in early enough in the morning to get a change made that we wouldn't know about. But usually we stayed around lots of times until 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning to get the thing sent down to correspondence, and they would type it for the president's signature from whatever we gave them. So we were usually a hotbed the night before a speech. And it was fascinating, it really was, to see the people who were very interested in what things went from their department and how it was said, and the people who weren't particularly, and the people who really looked out for their interests and made sure that somebody from their office was here until the last word was written, and the ones who sort of would leave and then let the people on the other side slip in and get something changed. And it was an interesting process. I always say that Jim Lim was the smartest man in the cabinet because he always came over himself and sat down, and just, you know, his presence was often enough to make the difference between something being written the way he wanted it written and the way somebody else wanted it.
Did you find that other offices within the complex were calling you for research assistance? I'll ask that question again. Were there other offices within the complex that might call you for research assistance or perhaps to even write speeches for them?
Very definitely.
Domestic Council will start with it?
The Domestic Council sometimes asked for assistance in just looking up things, you know, historical things from our files. They didn't too often ask for speeches. Some of the offices which more routinely have asked for help have been the counselors and people who are, Ann Armstrong, for instance, speaks quite often and did speak in the president's behalf, took scheduled items that he couldn't do, and it was felt, and quite rightly so, that she was speaking for the president. We should help her out as much as we could, and we did write a lot of speeches for her. We also did research for her office. We did things for, I think in the early days, we did a lot of research for various offices, and now I can't think of an example.
The First Lady
we did speeches for up until about a year ago, I guess, when Patty Matson was hired to come on her press staff in order to take up some of that responsibility. We had a person, Vera Hershberg, on our staff during the 72 campaign just to write for Mrs. Nixon and the girls. We wrote more for Julie, I guess, than anybody else.
Vice President?
In the early part of the first term, we did write a few speeches for Mr. Agnew, and then he got his own writers, and we stopped writing quite as much for him. Mostly that was done by Pat Buchanan and Bill Sapphire, who worked especially during the 1970 campaign almost exclusively for him. We did some of the research for those speeches until the president got busy during the same period, at which time we suggested that he get himself a researcher of his own, and Pam Giles, as a matter of fact, did work for him during that period.
National Security Council? I would be surprised if you did much, but I thought I'd ask you a little.
I'm trying to think whether I don't think that we've really done much for them, although they've done a lot for us. We call on them. They're more a source than a cause of work.
Council on International Economic Policy.
I think that we did some speeches for Peter Flanagan when he was head of that council. Before that, I don't recall that we had too much dealings with them. Again, we sometimes cleared things for them that were just routine transmittal messages and things like that, but I don't think that they caused us to do too much original research.
During the 72 campaign, a large number of administration spokesmen were going out throughout the country. Were you doing any research to assist in that publicity effort?
Yes. I can recall that we did quite a bit for just background fact sheet type things, which indirectly, I suppose, were used. And I think that spokesman's books were put together, as I recall, notebooks of information for the various people who were going to be giving speeches. And I think we even had sample speeches in those books. The research office had more influence really in doing the fact sheets, which were done basically by the domestic council, I think. And then we often took their information and supplemented it and double-checked it and changed some of the facts that somebody else didn't think they had right. And put these out, and I think we did them pretty often because some of the statistics were very, you know, time dated. They did wear very well. You know, on the economy, for instance, we were constantly having to do new fact sheets on the economy.
Throughout this period, just based on what you've already told me, it sounds like your hours were irregular and long at best.
Very.
What? Could you give me some idea, Anna, of what a week might be like?
During the early, Seal Bellinger had a very definite interest in getting out early, and her theory was that if anybody needed her after 6 o'clock or whenever she left, they could call her at home and she would just leave. And that worked for her for some reason, and I'm not ever sure why it worked. Because after she left, I always ended up getting stuck here, and I think it's that the staff was much simpler when she was there. It got very rapidly much bigger and much more involved in doing things that took a long time. One problem that we always ran into when the staff got very large was that there was a bottleneck situation where Ray Price or Dave Gergen had to look at everything, and we had to look at everything, so there were all these writers turning in this material to a small number of people who had to function on it. And either the front office or the research staff was constantly being yelled at to do things faster and to get it out. Somebody wanted that piece of paper right then. So we ended up working, I suspect, during the campaign. Also, the people on our staff have traditionally been people who worked better late at night than early in the morning. We've never been 7:30 arrivals at work. More likely it was 9 or 9:30 we would get to work and stay until we'd finish the work for that day. And sometimes, I would say in the last 2 or 3 years, it has not been usual for me to leave the office before 7 or 7:30. That has not always been necessary, but it became the habit, sort of, that if there was nothing else really pressing going on, I always just stayed and watched the news. And that's an important thing to do, too, I think. But that Saturdays. Was the early Saturdays, especially during the campaign, we always did work. During quieter times, we didn't, you know, it was not something that we did routinely just to be here. We were only here if we had to be on Saturdays.
During the campaign, I suppose you probably were Sundays too on occasion.
On occasion, we did. The campaign, even though it was very busy, though, was not terribly long, really. When I look back on it, it didn't last, you know, a couple of months. The busier time, almost, because it was longer, is missing. This office did have a cyclical sort of workload. It was very busy from the time of the State of the Union in late January until Easter time, maybe. During that period, all the legislative messages were being sent up. And the president, traditionally, I think, was just busier during that period, especially in the spring, with foreign visitors usually starting to arrive and various other things happening. In the summer, traditionally, things just quieted off. He would either go to California or would just not have quite so many things to do, except in an election year when things would start getting busy at the end of the summer.
So in a way, you were keyed somewhat to the congressional term or session.
More or less. I think all of Washington sort of runs on that sort of a schedule, but we found that we were much busier during the winter months. And during that time, as I say, we very often would stay with the message until the middle of the night. And usually then we didn't come in until the middle of the day, so we didn't die.
I have asked, I think, all the questions that I wanted to cover for that period. Is there anything that we've overlooked that you think is worthy of commenting on? If not, we can move on to the next session.
The only thing I can think of that might be helpful to have in the record somewhere is that it's just the impressions I built up about the president himself and the way he worked from doing research. We did quite often get, not quite often, I shouldn't say that, well, we did get requests directly from the president often for things. The first one I got, I remember, terrified me. It was in 69, I guess, the lighting of the Christmas tree, and it was during the period when Mrs. Bellinger wasn't here. Bob Haldeman called and said, the president wants to know how many radios, televisions, washing machines, and God knows what else there are in the United States who wants to use it in this speech. And you know, it was one of those things that nobody was at his desk. It was lunchtime, and nobody in the whole government was in his desk and knew where to find it. But things like that we would get. And also, the only time I talked to the president on the phone about something was word counts for a speech. He was very concerned with having speeches, big speeches, inaugural addresses, States of the Union addresses. Be short, and he often wanted to compare their length with other presidents. And I remember for his second inaugural, he was down in Key Biscayne working with Ray Price on it, and he called up and wanted to know how long, I think, Teddy Roosevelt's inaugural address had been in words, and we counted the words and called him back, and he said, well, how about Kennedy's? And so we counted the words and called him back. Which it was interesting just to learn how it worked. The other thing that we did was look up quotes. And I gradually learned over the years that the favorite quotes that Richard Nixon uses now, he's always used. And the easiest way to find one is to look back in an old speech and see if it was ever looked up again, if he looked up before, because the ones, especially the hard ones, were ones that he remembered from a night. Once he remembered a quote from a 1960 speech, and this is more than 10 years later. He remembered it almost perfectly, but when I wanted it looked up. I think this was the last Lincoln Day speech. He remembered a Lincoln quote that he had used many years before, and asked Frank Gannon to see if we couldn't find it for him. His memory was quite remarkable about things like that.
You said that he preferred short speeches. Could you be more specific on that?
Well, again, this is something that I got secondhand, mostly from Ray Price, who wrote almost all of those speeches. I can't remember exactly a word count. I think his State of the Union speeches ran about 30 minutes, which was very short. In historical context, I think many of them were hours long, and many of the recent presidents were much longer than half an hour. But he thought, and I think he was absolutely right, that they get very boring after more than half an hour.
Well, when did you leave the research office?
At about the time that there was the big shuffling of bodies after the second inaugural, when there was, as you know, a concerted effort to have people move if they wanted to move, and realign themselves if they felt themselves out of line, or to at least reevaluate the job that was being done. And we all had to write little papers on our jobs and what we thought could be done with them. And it was at that time that Ray Price decided he didn't want to be the head of the staff anymore. He was really tired of the administrative headache that it was, and he moved over to a sort of satellite position, hoping not to have to write too many more speeches, but not succeeding. And at that time, Dave Gergen moved up to fill his position, and he needed somebody to do what he had been doing, which was really being administrative assistant to him. And I decided that I was sort of burned out in the research area. I've heard this said by several people. I remember Lee Huebner used to say that once you've done a message season and a state visitor season two or three times, it does get a little bit old. You know, you can only do so many messages to Congress on health care without wanting to do something else for a while. And I decided that I wasn't looking forward to that particular season, and so I decided it was time for me to do something else. So I moved down the hall. And
helped. Approximately, would that have been what, the first 3 months of 73?
It was, I believe that I actually changed jobs in maybe February, early February.
All right, what have you been doing since February 73 then?
Many, many things. Basically, I guess in the very beginning, it was a about personnel problems were my major concern, because a lot of people were leaving, the staff were finding other jobs, we were cutting back considerably. The election was over, we thought, you know, we had a long period of not quite so busy times. We were hiring, I think at that time we lost almost all the secretaries on our staff. We were hiring secretaries right and left.
Were you the one that was interviewing those secretaries?
I was doing the basic, gathering of resumes and calling people for interviews and winnowing down to the, you know, the number of people who could be talked to by the principal who was looking for a secretary. I think what else I did in the early time. Lots of very routine administrative work, you know, getting people's telephones in the right place and getting the rooms decorated and getting everybody in order. The basic job, though, which did develop, which is what I'm doing now still, I guess, is that the amount of paper which comes into the editorial department for either clearance or action or just, you know, background type letters is just huge. Something that really needs a manager, and that's pretty much what I was. I went through all the incoming stuff and routed it to whoever on our staff was free to do something. Proclamations come in just routinely. What I would do if a proclamation came in was assign it to a writer who would then normally rewrite it, because it probably either didn't sound like Richard Nixon or didn't sound like anybody you'd want to know. And then the research office would have a chance to look at it, and then it would come back to me. And normally it would then be looked at by Dave Gergen, or else it would just be, you know, if it was very good and I could tell right away that it was good and there was a short time period, it would just be sent back where it came from, which was normally over to the staff secretary's office or to the domestic council staff secretary office is now taking over most of that. Other things that I did, I still sort of kept an eye on the research operation. They, for a while, were supposed to be giving everything they did to me still to look at, and gradually Pam got very, very good at it, and I didn't worry about her anymore at all. I did, though, follow who was doing what, you know, whether there was too much being, you know, given to one writer or even too much being given to research at any one time, if there were projects that could be put off. You know, it was a policeman role, really. Other things that I, you know, went to meetings for Dave, found out what was going on, you know, found out what the president's schedule, you know, most of this job really is following the president's schedule, figuring out what remarks and speeches and things are coming up and what we need to know about the event, finding a writer to do it, telling research about it.
So you might have been in touch with Dave Parker's office to keep on top of what was being planned. Not only within the next week or so, but in the next several months.
Right. That, I think that's a problem that never was fully solved. I think that the Nixon White House was a very efficient organization. I really have always thought that it usually ran very well. There were some areas, though, where things didn't do too well, and that was one of them. I think it was very hard for everybody to always know what was going on in the president's schedule. Toward the end, there were meetings that were held every morning. George Jowen chaired a meeting, which I often went to for Dave, which probably was the best way to do it. You just have to get together and have everyone say what he knows in one room, and that way people aren't on the telephone all day trying to find out what you know about what's going on. Even then, sometimes things do change, and that was a lot of my job, was just being on the phone with people, figuring out whether the president was going to do something, when he was going to do it, who was doing the paper, who needed the information, who had the information.
One question I failed to ask about your activities in the research area, did you travel much during that earlier period?
I didn't travel at all during the earlier period. The only place I went at all before I moved out of this job was to the convention in August of 72. And almost all of our staff went down there for that. That was a fascinating little bit of history, too. We worked very closely with the people who were doing the script. As you recall, there was a script for that convention, and it was well done. You know, lots of people criticized it, but the speeches were looked at by the White House writing staff, and in lots of cases, the researchers were very involved in making sure that I sat in a hotel room with Bryce Harlow and Ed Harper and three or four college volunteers all day one day doing the platform. And I'm sure that Mr. Harlow to this day cannot figure out what I was doing there, but I was in fact checking the platform, making sure that in fact things, not again, policy things, you know, we weren't in the business of making policy, but very often in a background sort of paragraph in the platform, especially in the 72 platform, there were lots and lots of references to accomplishments, you know, things we had done, we had bought the inflation rate from such and such to such and such, and I was there to make sure that we had the facts straight, because that document was not only the platform of the Republican Party that year, it was a very good source document for speakers, and we wanted to make sure it was right. That's one of the things that I did.
Have you been traveling much since you moved up as administrative assistant today?
I have had one very, very good summer of traveling. As I told you earlier, we did decide sometime, I think, last year that it was very good to have a researcher go with the pre-advanced team into places. And Pam Giles made several trips, and some of the people on her staff did. And I think everyone, including the Advanced Office Society, was a very good way to do things. Luckily, that practice was well established when the two foreign trips that the president made this past summer came up. And it was decided for one reason or another that I would be the best person to go on the pre-advance. There was very little notice. There was 2 days, I think, notice. And I took off on June 3rd and came back with the president in July when he came back from the Soviet Union. Traveled with the advance party all over the Middle East and into the Soviet Union. And was there also while the presidential party was there.
So you're not only with the pre-advance party,
right,
but you were with the actual
right
party.
The difference in this case was that the pre-advance and the advance and the trip all ran together because there was not enough time. Normally, the advance team would have liked to have a month, and we had 2 weeks, I think. And by the time we went first to the first stop, the president would make a week later. So we had 1 week to do it, and the very next week he was going to be there. It was really amazing.
How about documentation of that type of thing? Was it such a hurried operation that there just wasn't much put down on paper?
No, there was, because what I did every day was send a cable back here of what I had learned that day. Well, some days I didn't if we were traveling all day, but in every stop, at least up until the point at which it was no longer possible for the writing staff to do it, when the president was in the air by the time we were doing the advance in Amman, Jordan, I think. I would just cable today, Gergen, what I thought he needed to know about that stop, and I think that material is in his file.
So that would have come to?
It came to Dave Gergen, but copies, I'm sure, went all over. I think copies went to Dave Parker, maybe, who was doing the scheduling back here. I'm sure there are copies of those cables in the files. There also probably are files, well, I'm sure there are files from the trip that the writing staff prepared, and possibly copies of that material is in those files.
Well, it sounds like, from what you said, that whoever might want to track you would be able to do it fairly well for both jobs that you've held.
I would hope so. I think that you people have your work cut out for you in trying to sort out, because there are lots of things that overlap. The various writers' files, for instance, and the researchers' files and the files that were kept in the front office probably will all have to be put together before you have any clear picture of how a speech was. You know, if you wanted to take a particular speech and trace who had anything to do with it, there have to be a lot of getting together of the files, but once that's done, I think you could have a pretty good idea of what people, in some cases, a lot of people, had something to do with something that the president said.
Would it be fair to assume that during your entire time, whether with the research operation or as administrative assistant, that almost all speeches, messages, or what have you would have crossed your desk at some point?
Almost all, yes.
And you would have had some input, whether it be, as you say, a nitpicking role or a more substantive role of providing information.
Right, of course, there will have been exceptions.
Oh, yes.
When I was in the research office and we were dividing things, there are some things that I didn't have that much to do with. But especially when I was head of the research office and since I've been down in the front office, so to speak, I suspect I have seen almost everything that's been done. Normally, another thing that I sort of did for Dave Gergen at Sahara, I suspect for the last year or two, there probably isn't as much on paper about my job, and my files and his are the same. I didn't keep separate files. A lot of what I did was just oral. It was done on the telephone. It was done calling someone at his request and telling him what that person said. But I also often would just sit in his office and read a draft and just tell him what I thought about it. You know, I would say, gee, this is a little bit too hard line, or this, I think, doesn't quite state the point the right way. He used me often as a sounding board, just because I had been there a long time and sort of knew what the president probably would want to say.
Your daily routine, once you became administrative assistant, was there any pattern to that as opposed to when you were in the research operation? The hours you kept, any regular meetings that you attended?
I don't think it changed that much because the whole staff, the writers were in a different position because each one of them had a special task each day maybe, but both in my present job and as head of the research office, the hours just depended on what was being done that day. If there was a big speech, then everything else sort of went out the window, including lunch and getting home for dinner. And other days that there wasn't that much to do, one could go back and do all the work that was supposed to have been done the week before.
So
I would say that recently, there have been so many atypical times recently, but maybe last winter I often would come in for a meeting in the morning. I did try to read the newspaper every day. I thought that was important. At least one newspaper, at least the first section of one newspaper. And I would go through the incoming stuff and sign it out, and by that time it would usually be lunchtime. And in the afternoons, once a week or so, we had a staff meeting, which I think was a very good thing to have, where we just exchanged views of what's going on and who had problems and who thought what about what. I did writer's schedules at least once a week. Usually we try to have meetings at the beginning of the week, at which time I would hand out a writer's schedule of what was on the schedule at that point, what each writer was required to do, and by when, and when the event was, and which writer was doing it, so that everybody would know what was going on.
Would those schedules be written down? Would we find copies of those in
the
files?
There should be complete copies.
Sounds like a very good document if we wanted to trace the operation.
As a matter of fact, I'll double check on that because I know I kept copies, and I think there are copies in the files of the regular front office files.
You would have been the person who would have made the decision as to who was going to.
Well, not always. I always did that. I would usually, for a big speech, I would definitely, and sometimes even for little things, ask Dave Gergen what he thought about a certain writer doing this particular thing that's just come up. For little things, proclamations. Minor messages that didn't really, I would just give it to whoever had the time that day, or on the schedule, who had the fewest things to do that week. For a big speech, it often depended. Some of the writers did get very specialized. Noel Cook, for instance, did almost all the energy things during the energy crisis. And that was a good thing because he went to lots of meetings that if he hadn't been the expert, no one would have gone to. Because we wouldn't have sent anybody because it wasn't a speech-related meeting, but he got to know a lot about the subject and was much more better able to do the speeches and messages and things that came along.
You would have set the deadlines, too, for those, huh?
Usually, yes. Lots of times those deadlines were based on our arbitrary deadlines we had from the West Wing, because they always tried to get things in early enough so that other people could see them before they went to the president. On big speeches, it often depended on when the president had the time to see them. You know, we would go through several drafts went through several periods of radio speech series, and we got down to sort of a pattern on those that we would do several drafts and circulate them. Well, another thing that I did and do is circulate things with Dave Green. Again, we both do sort of the same things, and if he's very busy, I do more than if he's not, because he, again, had my job before I did, and so he knows very well how to do things, and if I'm doing something else, he can do almost anything that I do and does. You know, so of course he can do it, but he does do some of these things. But one of the big headaches in our whole system is making sure that everybody who needs to see something has seen it before it goes to the president. And that means with a speech on, say, a radio speech on transportation, an early draft would have to be sent to OMB, to the Domestic Council, to Bill Timmons, to, well, the personalities change, but there are just a set number of people. Press secretary always got cut in on these things. Sometimes we dealt directly with the departments when we sent an extra copy to the department. Sometimes the Domestic Council handled that for us. And then all these comments, and we would send it out with a memo saying, please return your comments by a certain time. And then all the comments would come in, and often I would put together a master, or the writer would put together a master, or Dave Gergen would put together a master with all those comments. And often the comments would come in over the phone, and you would discuss with people what. Sometimes the comments would be very broad and sweeping, like, this is a miserable speech and I hate it. But that takes up a lot of time, just the circulating of speeches. And often we would go through several of those drafts before we got something which everybody agreed was good enough to send in to the president. And we would do that, and he would send them back with his comments. Occasionally he would call for a writer to come over and talk to him about it. More often he would just do it on paper, as was his preference. He was a very good editor, and he would just go through and mark it up the way he wanted it changed, sometimes very lightly edited, sometimes he would completely rewrite sections. And once he had done that, we would then do another draft and send it to him, and that was usually it. This is for a radio speech or something like that.
The comments from the various people to whom you circulated the draft, you said frequently would come in and written form or sometimes over the phone. Would those comments be written down somewhere?
They should be. In the early period, I think that those things were... Jim Keogh didn't keep files, as I recall. He liked to get rid of stuff and send it to the files, and I think we pretty much sent those things on. I don't think we kept many of those things in the research office. There may be some of those comments that ended up in the research office because they would be sent down as part of backup material, saying, you know, this is where I got that fact. It was sent to me by the Secretary of HEW or whatever in his comments. They should have been kept in the front office in a file or by the writer in a file, and they should be all in the papers. Sometimes for a State of the Union message, when we started doing the written State of the Union messages, the first one was done by Lee Huebner, and his whole office looked like a file drawer. You know, we went through a number of drafts, and of course with something like that, every agency in the government had to be sent a copy because everybody was affected, and the comments that came back would have filled truckloads. But he was very good, I'm sure. Again, being a historian, he was very good about keeping things and sending them on.
Well, I'm impressed with what you told me in terms of the documentation. Not only you did, but the other people in the office. We may have to do, as you suggest, go from one office to another mm-hmm. office to another office to track something. But nevertheless, somewhere we're going to find the information. And that's a lot better than ending up with a dead end street saying, I don't know where it is, or was there documentation done? So, all in all, it sounds very good. A couple more questions I'll throw out to you. As far as your title was concerned, once you became his administrative assistant, was that in fact your official title? Or
no,
did you retain
it was just staff assistant.
Did you have a secretary?
He had two secretaries, which we shared, and they served both of us.
What were their names?
Jan Barberi and Kathy Coon.
last one's Kathy?
Koob, K-O-O-B.
Where could we reach you, let's say, in the years to come, when we start going through these files and have questions to ask? Would you have a permanent name and address, your parents' address, your alumni association, professional organizations? We've got a whole list of things.
Right. I suspect my parents' address is probably the most stable. I have no visions of leaving my current address at any time in the near future, but I suspect that's a possibility. And my parents are in Columbia, South Carolina, at 4130 Blossom Street.
B-L-O-S-S-O-M.
It's Mr. and Mrs. J-H.
Did you do any writing of anything that might have appeared in magazine or newspaper or in the land? Brent, let me qualify that even more. That would have had your name on it.
No.
As having been written by him. Were there any articles that appeared in newspapers or magazines that you, for all intents and purposes, wrote?
I don't think so. There were a number of things that were done by the staff, and I wouldn't say that I had written any of them. There were, as you know, a lot of op-ed pieces that went out over other people's names that were done by the writing staff, but I didn't write any other person.
General question. What was it that gave you the most satisfaction? You got an answer? We throw this out. Sometimes you get an answer, and sometimes people just throw up their hands and say, I can't answer that question. Is there any one event, any one assignment, just a general feeling?
I can't think of a specific event that gave me the most satisfaction. There were, of course, certain speeches and or messages that I worked on that were very satisfying. I can't think right now which ones they might have been. It was very satisfying, especially on the research side, to do a speech and to know that you'd done it well and that it was a good speech and that everything went well. The trip last summer was satisfying because I think that it was not that I had that much personally to contribute. Mostly I was just gathering information and sending it on, but I think the team as a whole did a really outstanding job under just terribly difficult circumstances. And it was very satisfying to have been a part of it.
I will press that issue. Perhaps when we get around to talking to you again at some future point, we may zero in on particular messages or speeches if that may have some comments to make. I believe that hits all of the questions. And not having to watch, I don't know if I've run over my hours limit or not, but.
It's about 11:15.
Well, I have. I apologize for that.
Oh, that's fine.